Welcome to The Pulse. I'm Kamaran Peter, the Executive Head of the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change, an organization dedicated to countering online mis- and disinformation and building tolerance and understanding. I'm here today with Chris Roper, the Deputy CEO of Code for Africa, which is the largest federation of civic technology and data journalism labs on the continent. Chris serves as the director for Code for Africa's Forensic Initiative, the African network of centers for investigative reporting. Chris's role at Code for Africa was underwritten by the International Center for Journalists Knight Fellowship. Prior to joining Code for Africa, Chris was editor-in-chief of the well-known Mail and Guardian and editor-in-chief of 24.com as well. Today, we're here to discuss the role of mis- and disinformation in undermining democracy, and we'll be focusing on South Africa in particular.
Now, South Africa is not unique in that it's also experiencing significant socio-political division and polarization, a lot of which is fueled by online misinformation and disinformation, particularly on social media. It's a global phenomenon, but today we're going to focus a bit on South Africa and how we're handling it in this context. So many people are working on mis- and disinformation in social media, but you at Code for Africa have taken a novel approach. Tell us about the game you just launched to address mis- and disinformation in partnership with CABC, Digital Public Square, and the Mail and Guardian. How does it work? You know, what's the intention behind it? And what's the response been so far?
Sure, thanks very much for having me on the show. Maybe I'll start by contextualizing just a little bit about what Code for Africa does, which kind of leads us to how we get to the point of this game, which I think is called You Versus the Internet, a fairly grandiose title, but kind of what we all experience on social media every day, I assume. So Code for Africa, part of what we do is we work in over 21 African countries monitoring misinformation and disinformation. So using kind of big machine learning, natural language processing platforms to monitor, to listening on social media, to monitor digital news media outlets and so on, to kind of get an idea of the scope of misinformation and disinformation, and get an idea of who is behind it. You know, is it ideologically driven? Is it for profit driven? That kind of thing. So, and again, part of that is that we have a fact-checking unit called PESACHECK, which monitors misinformation specifically on Facebook. And I think we're Facebook's third largest fact-checking partner in the world. There we take down something like, I don't want to misstate the numbers, but it's probably like a couple of million pieces of fake misinformation a year, I would say. So all of that kind of gives us an insight around what, the scale of the problem and what needs to be done. So there's the kind of investigative side of it. There's the fact-checking side. But I think the most important side, and I think this is going to come up in our conversation today, is the act of enlisting your fellow digital citizens to help you with the fight against misinformation. So part of what this game is intended to do is that it is an educational game. It allows you to kind of, first of all, almost fact check your own kind of confirmation biases and your own predilection to fall for misinformation by going through a system of a gamified system of questions. But then it also kind of teaches you it teaches you to become aware of things like your predilection for sensationalism, or teaches you to become aware that a piece of information that you're about to share doesn't actually have an official source, that kind of thing. And what we're hoping is that, and what DPS is hoping, Digital Public Square, is that this kind of educational process will be both extremely useful to people in that they will become, trained up to be fighters against misinformation in their personal capacity, but also that because it's going to be fun, potentially, that it's something you're going to want to pass on. So it's kind of a way to mushroom effect of getting people to think much more clearly about what constitutes misinformation and how to safeguard against it.
That sounds fantastic, because it's one of those critical things in society right now across the world, where we've got tech moving ahead of a lot of the regulations, a lot of the codes that have traditionally been in place, particularly in journalism. And what we're really looking to do is create educated consumers of information. What's been the response so far?
Yes, so we've done this in South Africa and Ethiopia, and it's quite early days in terms of doing a comprehensive analysis of impact and so on. But when DPS have done this games before, they've had, I think they've done it in Tibet, for example, and I think Iraq. They've had a lot of great response and produced quite a big impact in terms of, you know, people using it and then people spreading it as well. So it's a bit early days for us to see what it is for South Africa because it's just been launched. But, you know, I mean, obviously the hope is that it will be shared widely.
Do you anticipate there'll be any specific contextual characteristics that are specific to the continent? And I don't mean the whole continent, but the diversity of regions on the continent that might influence how it's taken up, for example?
Well, certainly the games have a country-specific examples. You know, so it'll be specific examples about, for example, you know, Chinese sponsored content on the independent media platform, for example. So one of the examples will be, you know, here's a piece saying that the whole Uyghur question in China is not a genocide. Here's a think piece by the Chinese ambassador paid for in Independent. So the game takes you through a process of saying, you know, do you think this is misinformation or do you think it's trustworthy? If you say you think it's misinformation, it'll say yes, and we assume it's because you saw that it was sponsored content, you saw that it was a government spokesperson. If you say no, I believe it, it'll say, well, you know, you might want to rethink that. You might want to say, you know, you might want to think about the fact that it's a Chinese government spokesperson that's paid for content. And of course, as we know, that's also on the independent platform, but I don't think that's actually in the game. And then, you know, you level up in a gamified way. So if you do answer one incorrectly, you go down a level and then you have opportunity to self-correct. And that's the kind of educational part of it. So it's just to answer your question more specifically, the game's tailored for different locations, different countries, different geographical specifics. So it's not going to, you know, even though the machinations of misinformation are identical across the continent, across the world, actually, you know, the specific examples are going to be different. In some countries, and I think you wrote about this recently in the City Press, in some countries, xenophobia is kind of like the most lucrative way of spreading misinformation because it buys into a whole bunch of tropes around, you know, other Africans and so on. Whereas, you know, I can imagine that in other parts of Africa, there would be a different kind of major trope. You know, say West Africa, it might be around French, you know, neo-colonialism, that kind of thing. So it'll just depend on the country.
Oh, that's fascinating. And, you know, just out of interest, you know, an app like this, you know, could it, is it specifically targeted against for adults or could it also be used like with children and teenagers? Because I think my intuition says we need to start schooling people from a very young age about how to engage with this new media landscape.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And the game is targeted certainly not at children. But I mean, you know, your definition of what child is and how news literate a child is, I think is going to be, I mean, that's quite a complex discussion. You know, so for example, news on TikTok at a much younger market that requires a high degree of literacy, a different kind of literacy perhaps to news consumption on Facebook or on News 24. So I must say, Cameron, it's not a question that I thought about for this podcast. But it certainly is a fascinating one. You know, like at what age does a certain kind of news literacy kick in? And at what age does the susceptibility to misinformation change? Is it on the continuum? I don't actually know the answer to the question. It's a fascinating question.
Well, we'll earmark it for some academic studies.
Yeah.
you know, you spoke about independent media and sponsored content and how, you know, the media is being skewed either for, you know, domestic political, foreign political, but also economic interests. in this kind of new media landscape. And I use the term new here in inverted commas because it's been a long time coming, as you are more aware of than me. I was just lucky enough to read Manufacturing Consent very early on in my career. So, I'm informed from that perspective. And I was just thinking, in South Africa, but in OECD countries around the world, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a steady decline in the four institutions that produce a democracy, which is government, business, civil society, and media. And South Africa's fared really badly on this Edelman barometer, which is the measure that's been going now for quite a few years. And while there are slight changes and shifts in them, generally in most of these countries, particularly where we've seen political polarization and disruption, it's been very significant decline in what more broadly can be regarded as the establishment. But these are core institutions to producing a democracy, and particularly media. Turning to South Africa, just drawing on your independent media reference, how are our media and democratic institutions faring when it comes to supporting democracy?
I'm most comfortable talking about media because, we've been immersed in quite a few studies around media in different African countries, and it's the area we work in. If I can start with that one. One of the things that Code for Africa also does is we help the Reuters Oxford Institute for Journalism to do the Nigerian and South African parts of their digital news report every year. And one of the metrics that is measured in those reports is trust in the media. And one of the unusual things, one of the noteworthy things is that the three African countries they survey, which are Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya, they show a really high trust in the media compared to the rest of the world. So of the 46 countries that are monitored, for example, South Africa is second highest trust in the media out of all those countries. Finland is just one percentage point higher than us. And the question is, do you trust your news media in your country? Kenya is 6 out of 46 of the markets, and Nigeria is 4th, I think, at 58%. So there's an interesting dynamic happening there where trust in media in, let's talk about South Africa specifically, trust in media in South Africa is much higher than it is in the rest of the world. Now, for me, trust in media is one of the kind of bastions of a democracy. The fact that a democracy is based on an informed electorate, what informs the electorate, one of the pillars that informs the electorate is a free media. So therefore, having a trusted media, I think, is a very important, a very positive step for South Africa. But at the same time, this trust in media extends across all our media titles. I mean, to different degrees. News24 is highest. And it goes down like a sort of a long list. We only look at, I think, 15. Daily Sun is somewhere like second last, that kind of thing. But there's still quite high trust levels. So on the one level, you want to say, look, we're strong here as a democracy because we have trusted media. But on the other level, you want to say, but how come that people are also expressing trust in titles like independent media? We know blatantly lie about invent 10 babies. How can there still be trust there? So I think one of the things that is happening is that our media is becoming, like our political landscape, much more polarized. Whereas if you looked at this kind of like maybe 5 years ago, you would have seen a much greater middle of the road, or rather like a middle of the landscape, medium kind of a voice, where most of our news organizations were kind of in the moderate middle, now becoming much more polarized. So your question, I think it's quite a complicated answer to say, is something, for example, like the media still strong as a pillar of democracy? Yes, it is. But does that mean that there aren't some kind of pitfalls approaching we have to look out for? And I think, yes, there are, because that trust is something that can be abused. And I think we find you've seen on social media, for example, there's a lot of misinformation and what used to be called fake news, which plays on the trust. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a destabilization that's happening, which if we aren't careful and we don't push back against it, and of course this game is, you know, a small attempt to push back against that, to teach people to tell the difference between real news they can trust and, you know, brands or news they can't trust. Unless we keep pushing back that, I think we're going to see an erosion of that pillar. The other kind of pillars of our democracy are things like the independent judiciary, as well as independent media, things like our constitution. And I guess we're all very attuned to the attacks on the constitution by the clowns like Karl Niehaus and by the kind of radical economic transformation faction, although they're better F words than faction for them. But, you know, we're all seeing this kind of these attacks on the media, on the constitution. And if I was an external observer and not actually, to live in the middle of it, I would be finding this super interesting to see, like, you know, how will this battle turn out? Will the media and the kind of the NGOs for good and citizens, will they be able to push back against this kind of tides of misinformation that are coming from the highest levels down to the lowest, like for-profit fake news sites levels? You know, who's going to win this battle and how's it going to play out? It's going to be interesting if you're an observer. Of course, we're active participants, so it's still interesting, but maybe a little bit more scary.
Yeah, so, in a sense, this high trust in media across the board is more representative of how, you know, and I don't want to say this in a pejorative sense, but being not discriminating enough about how we consume media. And because, as Herman Wasserman, who we've had on the show before, Professor Herman Wasserman would say, you know, the truth is socially constructed. Is that the danger is that there's different socially constructed truths being generated from these media sources, which then leave us polarized as a society. And the game is a good sort of starting point to this. But if we look at some of the specific fracture lines, like you mentioned, the radical economic transformation faction, which is a political project in its rhetoric, in the sense that it's invoking this neo-patrimonial developmentalism, that some compromises have to be made and sort of separation of powers needs to give a little bit of way and the constitution has to give a little bit of way in order for us to have the developmental kind of progress that we want. But it has, you know, it has pushed certain deep fracture lines in our society. And I want to talk a little bit about those fracture lines. How do you see them, you know, from a media perspective? What are those fracture lines currently, and how is it impacting us as a country?
Yeah, I mean, by fracture lines, do we mean, for example, like factionalism within the ANC that plays out in the media? It's like pro Cyril Ramaphosa versus pro Jacob Zuma, those kinds of fracture lines?
And more broadly in society, you know, where society itself is more polarized in, you know, there was a kind of moderate middle that the majority of society subscribed to before. But now there's a hodgepodge and a mix of very different kind of media streams, all of which are being trusted by the public. How is that translating into our socio-political fabric as a society? You know, so beyond, I suppose, the ANC, but us as a society itself.
I mean, I think one of the effects of this kind of proliferation of what you're calling fracture lines, but which could also be called like a multiplicity of different voices, but not voices in the kind of academic sense, but like actually a lot of people shouting a lot of stuff. I think, you know, one of the results of that is that a language is being created where, because of access to social media platforms and so on, where people are starting to be driven into niches, into factions, into almost like hermetic interest groups. I mean, if we're going to talk about institutions, like an AfriForum would be one of those, or what are those idiot Cape people called?
The secessionists.
Those morons. Not to find a point in it. You're driven into those positions. But, of course, all those positions are also revenue-generative positions, you know, and also kind of positions where you can accrue a certain kind of power. And I think, so on the one level, that I think is also one of the positive paths forward for media, in that you can now create niche audiences. You know, so just take a step back and look at the kind of condition of media ecosystem as a whole. The problem there is that only the big players are earning enough revenue to do a lot of journalism, because it's kind of a model of the volume is privileged. Not volume in terms of shouting, as well as the volume in terms of how many readers you have and how much product you're producing. But the fact that people are now being kind of forced to consider themselves as defining themselves as niches means that they can now cleave to niche news products, for example, like a Daily Maverick audience, for example, would be the most obvious kind of example of that. So it's kind of both a strength of the way the media ecosystem is evolving, but in terms of the societal infrastructure you're talking about, I think it's got massive opportunity for misuse. Of course, and we've seen all the kind of RET and Cape Secessionists, all kinds of different groupings that are kind of like coalesce around each other on social media. So I think, if I was going to just like make a blanket statement, I'd say it's one of the most dangerous moments for our democracy in terms of, ideologically speaking. It's one of the most dangerous moments because of that fractured multiplicity of voices and how many bad actors there are taking advantage of that. But at the same time, I think maybe you were writing about this. I was reading something about it last week. At the same time, it's kind of like what a democracy is, right? A democracy is supposed to be this, a free for all of everybody getting a say, and a consensus agreement being reached. Whether there's enough space, time, and kind of room for application in the way discourse works at the moment, with this kind of daily barrage of new messages, whether we can take advantage of these multiple voices having access to platforms is another question, I think. So I would say, I'm both pessimistic and optimistic about the effects of this multiplicity of voices.
That was a great answer. Thanks, Chris. I think, your expertise is really coming through in terms of enlightening us. You spoke about, being at a dangerous point in South Africa. And I think anecdotally, from my perspective, I've seen a lot of similarities between what's transpired in the US, and I say this anecdotally because it's not something I'm studying actively, but from a lot of colleagues and friends who have been in the US, who actually some of them are leaving, have really felt like the social and the political contract in the US has broken down. And my sort of anecdotal observation is that that's kind of what's been happening in our country as well. In fact, there's quite a lot of spillover between the kind of conspiracist discourses in particular between the US and South Africa. And in some of our work, we found that, there was a lot more of it in South Africa than in other countries that we studied in the continent, particularly with respect to COVID vaccine hesitancy, for example. So, just in terms, so more broadly as journalists speaking about our country, how close are we to that point of collapse in your estimation? And I realize you don't have a crystal ball, none of us do. And speaking to the role of social media, how significant has that been just in your view? Not necessarily in terms of quoting all the Oxford studies on it.
Yeah. My answer to the first part of the question would be, you're really asking the wrong person. I would way rather defer to the experts on on the evolution of our democracy and of the current state of our democracy. But you know, if I'm allowed to speak in terms of anecdotal, even my personal kind of anecdotally learned understanding of it, which again, I must emphasize is not one that anybody needs to take seriously here, but you know, the first glib answer would be, we're as close to disaster as we've ever been and as we've always been. So I don't think anybody looking back at the history of the recent history of South Africa is going to say, you know, oh my word, everything was fantastic and look at us now. I mean, you know, all the problems we're living with are fairly old problems. I mean, old in our democracy, which of course is a super young democracy. So, you know, just like last week's problems for kind of older democracies. You know, so I mean, the kind of like the descent into incompetence and irrelevance of the ANC has been happening for, you know, a couple of decades. I mean, you know, Jacob Zuma is a 15-year-old problem, essentially. So I guess we've always been tiptoeing around disaster as a country in some cases. I mean, and, you know, it's, of course, there are many positive tales you could tell about South Africa. But I think, you know, the kind of messy business of creating a democracy has just begun. You know, so I would say, you know, are we at a worse moment now than we were before? I would say no, except for the second part of your question. And that is the impact of misinformation, disinformation, the impact of, you know, how social media platforms, how dark social, the impact that has on kind of breaking up the workings of our democracy. It's not to say that those voices haven't been haven't always been at work in our democracy. You know, the voices of those trying to evade accountability and responsibility and that kind of thing. But I think because of the condition of how truth is now seen globally, speaking very, very broadly, you know, the impact of things like the kind of descent of the American democracy into you know, a facsimile of what it purports to be and purported to be, that has given strength to a lot of bad actors in our country and across Africa, actually. You know, I mean, my just remember an example of during the SARS protests in Nigeria, of Nigerian police using extreme violence, and when asked, you know, how could justify doing that, saying, well, Donald Trump had said that it was okay for police in America to use extreme violence. So that kind of like directly one-to-one correlation. It's not, you know, it's not, it's just kind of like hypothetical. It's a direct one-to-one correlation. And I think the way people like Jacob Zuma and Iqbal Serwes of the world have decided that flat out lying is okay. And the way that their supporters have, in the same way that Trump supporters have bought into it, have decided that it's not a lie if they're telling it. You know, it's only a lie if somebody else is telling it. I think that has maybe changed quite fundamentally the nature of threats to democracy in South Africa. But right now, in the last couple of years, the way that misinformation and propaganda has been weaponized seems a lot cruder than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
You know, I mean, I recently, well, not recently, around December, January, wrote a piece where, you know, out of pure trying to understand the different movements that were transpiring and what that meant for the country and what kind of threat it presented. And, you know, just among them were things like, you know, unemployment, which was soaring. You know, globally, the wage gap has been increasing really since the 80s. You know, that we have deep poverty. And recently we learned, you know, inflation is at its highest in 13 years. And I think it's provided a kind of, you know, especially if you combine it with the gross inequality in our country, which by some measures, like the World Bank, has been the highest in the world for a long time, even higher in our cities. It provides that fodder for exploitation of people who are, of people on all sides of the spectrum, actually, or on all parts of the spectrum. And so my feeling, or the way of thinking about it, was like, we just don't know what thread could be pulled that unravels the whole carpet. But interestingly enough, I got a lot of responses, you know, on the Facebook feed, which I always pretend I don't read, but I did read this one. There were a lot of South Africans who expressed that opinion that, you know, we're used to going to the brink and we're not going to believe in the disaster stories anymore. And I think that's true to a large degree. We have a history of going to the brink and coming back because we do have a social fabric that somehow manages to hold together despite the different challenges that it's placed under. But I think we should never be complacent. It's important to keep in mind, like, to be watching and to be, you know, watchdogs for democracy and for social cohesion and for active citizenry in the country, making sure that that is what underpins our democracy. So, I mean, taking these kind of like optimistic and threats into account, how do you see things unfolding? And I suppose more pointedly, what role can the media play? You know, and I know it's a fraught landscape because of changes in how the media is functions today, you know, its business models, the works. But what's the vision for a kind of new media?
I mean, I'm not going to have the arrogance to attempt to answer that question, you know, with some, with kind of commitment. But what I will say is that there's no one answer, obviously, but equally, there's not even a dozen answers. There are unfortunately hundreds of answers. So because of the nature of the contested terrain of democracy at the moment in South Africa, which is kind of like reflected globally as well, there are so many moving parts to disinformation. I mean, I'm saying disinformation, but I mean kind of attacks upon democracy. There's so many moving parts. I mean, you know, just taking one random example, you know, 10% of all ad spend, digital ad spend globally, in America, 10% of digital ad spend goes to fake news websites. So 10% of all the money that corporations spend on advertising goes to actually fund the misinformation industry. It's a massive, massive amount of money. And it's similar in South Africa. So just that one example, you know, if we could say to corporations, let's do something about the 10% that you are funding misinformation with without knowing that you're doing it. Let's take some of that and use that to fund reputable news, for example. That's one intervention which immediately would strengthen democracy massively, right? And I mean, they're kind of like hundreds of those examples, you know, of kind of contested sub-areas in a democracy that we need to attend to. And that's kind of quite a daunting prospect, I think. But what underpins all of that is education, data, knowledge, you know, the kind of unpacking of those problems. And that's the role that the media plays. And I don't envisage I do. I mean, I think that the new way of operating for the media that would benefit democracy dramatically is to kind of almost go back to an old way of operating, which is predicated upon social media. So it's kind of the old and the new put together, which is the cultivation of community. You know, so I think we've become victim to the kind of broad volume-based, you know, programmatic advertising platform-driven kind of way of dissemination of knowledge, and that has broken many kind of parts of the American democracy, of the European democracies, of our democracy. I think we need to fight back quite dramatically against that kind of platform domination, and part of that is to exploit what those platforms have created, which is these kind of very polarized, niched communities. Because polarization is a negative term, but also, you know, it's not, if you're thinking of it as like groups that have their own specific take on the world, that's not that negative. So it's kind of like we need our media to cultivate the relationship. I think we spoke about it at the start of this, that relationship of trust that still appears to exist in South Africa, for example, with the media. To a degree, they need to cultivate that. And you need to get the citizens and the media working together on the problems. It's, you know, it sounds a little bit, idealistic. sounds a little bit idealistic, but in fact, it's not. In fact, it's kind of like it's both a business decision as well as a kind of a decision that's driven by wanting to do good in the world. And I think that kind of a sweet spot is what we need to work towards, what the media needs to work towards. Of course, the media is also a massive shambling, totally not homogenous edifice as well. But in general, that's what I would say. It needs to be much more of a collaboration between media houses and the audiences that cleave to those media houses. And it's got to be a turning away from the kind of volume-driven, mass consumption kind of news.
There's some very interesting examples of that. You know, in some of the work I've done previously in my career, I've looked at projects like the Map Kibera project, which is an informal kind of settlement just outside Nairobi, which originally began with trying to put together a census where they thought, you know, it was 1 million people who lived there, and they got the citizens, particularly youth, involved in the census, and then found, well, actually there are 200,000 people. So it's a different scale of urban management challenge. Yeah. Then they got the youth involved in reporting in into the sort of urban development challenges that were, you know, if there's a flooded road here, so that, you know, the authorities could direct their resources more efficiently. Then they had a radio station, I think it was BBC funded, and they played quite a role even during the electoral unrest in Kenya that occurred, not in the previous election, but even the previous one. And so, you know, it becomes very viable. And I think these new experiments, my view is very similar to yours in terms of what can get active citizenry engaged with the media in a very positive way for society, you know. You know, particularly being able to have the kind of debates that we would have had in town halls previously, but to have constructive debates about, and so things that actually start brokering a social compact in democracy.
Can I just jump in there? Because you remind me of something that I probably should have said. I mean, what I'm suggesting is not something, you know, that is particularly original. So you're absolutely correct. You know, that is what is already being done. And even in, but in South Africa, I think people like News 24, Daily Maverick, at Ground Up, you know, they all are doing this. You know, even the big behemoth News 24 has a membership component now, a subscriber component, where you get, you know, where the relationship is that you are paying them for kind of premium content, but also premium experiences, getting to talk to the editors, that kind of thing. So it's not like, you know, I'm not claiming this is an original idea that I think that will be the next big thing. I think it's happening now. But what I am saying is that everybody has to come to this Democratic Party, so to speak. You know, I don't think there's enough buy-in from business, for example, to this idea. I don't think there's enough support for those media houses. I mean, there's a lot of support for you know, Daily Maverick and for News 24, but those are not enough voices, of course. There's a, you know, there are a whole other swathe of interest groups that need to be served. And I think, you know, so the kind of projects you're talking about are one aspect of it, but I think it's also the aspect of turning the major media houses into community newspapers as well, so to speak. You know, not that News 24 would like to be described as a community newspaper, but just like a really big community newspaper. It's probably what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And I think, I mean, an example like the one you're talking about in Kenya is we worked on a project called Map Makoko. So Makoko is this floating slum, it was called initially, but a floating village in Lagos, which has about 300,000 inhabitants. And what we did there was we trained, and there's no kind of like mapping of it or documentation. We trained young women to use drones and canoes to map that floating town. And, you know, the result of that was that there was a much better service delivery, much better communication between government and and inhabitants became much safer, all those kind of things. So I think it's both those things. It's like it's getting communities involved in their own communities, but then also communities of ideas, you know, so like pro-democracy communities, you know, that whether the kind of identifying factor between all the members is not class or race or income, but actually this kind of ideology, which I know can quite dangerously shift to some kind of fascism, but I think you know what I mean. You know, like we need to get people involved and into a trusted relationship with news organizations.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Makoko Settlement because it's another one of the case studies I regularly write about. You know, as a last question and as a bit of a stretch point here, I noticed you mentioned the role of the platforms. And it's something that interests me quite deeply at a personal level. You know, Facebook and Google, for example, are platforms that are largely run off centralized algorithms. And there have been critiques of how this manifests in the formation of echo chambers and reinforcing your biases and preferences and feeding you information that you're more likely to consume, but then which makes you more ignorant of other views, for example. And I wonder what your take might be, you know, particularly from being in the kind of organization that you're running. You know, there have always been alternatives in the tech world. I, when I first became a student, started coding, it was all done on Linux, you know. And nowadays we have the emergence of blockchain, for example. What potential, just as a parting speculative point, what potential do you think that those kinds of new platforms have for perhaps changing the landscape?
Well, it's obviously a complex question. I mean, I think in our experience of making pronouncements about new tech platforms, we have learned that the answer is always we'll have to wait and see, because who knows what will survive. But I do think things like blockchain have a lot of potential positive impact in terms of accelerated freedom of the press. Of being able to free yourself from kind of conventional revenue constrictions. I think that the kind of rise of AI, although of course that's been with us for a long time, but the kind of like some peak in interest in AI and the kind of accelerated interactions that news media is having with AI around the ethics of AI and how to use them, that kind of thing. I think that's also going to be something that has a potentially massively positive impact because it's going to allow news organizations to really speak to a multiplicity of audiences or have a more direct conversation with members of the audiences, I think. So, you know, I think that's, there's a lot of positive potential. But I also think that, you know, I was saying the same thing about Facebook and Twitter many years ago. And, you know, I was right, but also, you know, calamitously wrong as well, because, you know, the more the landscape is opened up, the more opportunity there is to kind of lose focus and to lose audience and lose revenue. You know, so, I mean, one of the things that old school journalists used to insist on was, you know, that it was good to listen to your audience, you know, that you had to give your reader what your reader wanted, because that was the kind of contract, you know. And that's kind of what the Facebook and platform algorithms are doing, right? They're giving readers what the readers want. So, you know, if your proposition or if one's proposition is actually we should know better than the algorithm what the reader wants, we should know better than the reader what the reader wants. You know, that's also an interesting question. Like, where do we draw the line here? You know, obviously the platform algorithms are based on producing revenue for the platforms. So, you know, but maybe that's the case with media as well, you know, that our choices are also about survival and sustainability. I don't think we can tell really what the impact of new technologies are going to be. But I do think that it's, you can't put genies back in bottles. So, you know, the best that I think the media can do is to make sure that they, you know, are along for the ride by choice rather than just as collateral damage.
Thanks, Chris. I suppose in many ways, you know, revolutions, you never know which way they're going to go. And so even revolutionary changes in tech and in different sectors, it's hard to predict. But I suppose what you're saying is that, you know, the good principles of journalism and the codes of conduct in journalism will probably stand the test of time, even though we have yet to see.
I think I'm hoping that. Yeah. And I mean, another whole area of conversation could be, you know, whose AI are we going to bow to? Is it going to be Chinese AI? You know, US produced AI. Whose system of privacy laws are we going to be able to afford? Can we afford to the kind of privacy and security that Europe demands, or as you know, a poor nation and a poor continent, is privacy a luxury? Are we going to go with you know some other form of interaction with technology, which you know makes sense to our peculiar conditions? So that's another kind of question that we're going to, you know, I mean, one of the problems is that we are definitely pawns in some kind of major, you know, major nations' power plays as well. So there's just so much that we have to keep an eye on. You know, it's not just simply, is the technology good? It's where does the technology come from? You know, is it good for us? What are we going to have to sacrifice? That kind of thing as well.
And to what ends? it is orientated. Chris, I want to thank you for, you know, your honest and thoughtful answers and for really doing your best to respond to what has been quite a wild array of questions. Thank you very much for joining us on The Pulse. And I'm quite sure our audience are going to be very interested in the views that you've shared.
Thanks very much. Some tough questions. I hope we dealt with them well. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Another episode of The Pulse, where we break down the issues affecting you as honestly as we can. Thank you, Chris, for your time and your candor in talking these issues through.